This is Lecture 5 in the series A Theory of Productive Activity, Profit, and Saving. Well, good morning once again. There is a little bit of wrap-up I wanted to do on the subject of the productive functions of businessmen and capitalists. I've set that off, presented that fairly extensively, I think. We're getting some feedback here. Pardon me? Okay, thank you. I've pointed out or explained extensively the productive functions of businessmen and capitalists and why on any standard there is no exploitation of the wage earners. On the contrary, they are responsible for real wages achieving a high and progressively rising level. By way of setting things to right, let us observe that it is under socialism that you have a genuine exploitation of labor. And it is socialism which is the economic system that is incapable of maintaining its slaves in their slavery. The Communist Manifesto should have been written about socialism. Now, why is this? Well, let's look at a few economic considerations first. The socialist state has a universal monopoly on production and employment. There is no profit or loss incentive under socialism. No socialist state official stands personally to profit by introducing any improvement in production, nor personally to lose if his activity is not efficient. There is no possibility of competition. The state owns everything. Now, under capitalism, as I've explained, the profit-loss incentive leads the businessman, each businessman, to try to introduce improvements. That's the means of making an above-average rate of profit. Competition eventually copies the improvements. The benefit is passed forward to the consumer. And this goes on endlessly. Under socialism, you don't have the profit-loss incentive. You don't have any competition. The average member of a socialist society is economically powerless. He has to take whatever the government decides to give him. And there is no compelling reason why the government should decide to give him anything more than minimum subsistence. Presumably, the government wants a large population to stay alive if they're not too short-sighted. And we know, of course, that is not always the case. They're willing, just as the Communist Manifesto says about capitalism, to work the workers to the point of exhaustion and death. That's the story of the gulags. They're not even as long-range as a private slave owner who knows that at least it's his own slave he's destroying by overwork. Slavery under socialism is more heinous than where the slaves are private property. Now, by the very nature of a socialist society, you have an aristocratic arrangement. You know, people are always amazed. They say, well, Marx promised us a classless society. How come in the Soviet Union there are special stores which are open only to the elite? How come only the top officials of the Communist Party, they can get automobiles and they have fancy villas and so forth, but Ivanov has to go for months on end without even being able to obtain a sausage? And they are constantly amazed, how did Stalin destroy this wonderful classless society? What's happened? Well, it's in the very nature of the case. Partly, it's the result of the economics, no freedom of competition, no profit-loss incentive, but it also follows directly from the moral political nature of a socialist society. Consider the leading moral political premise. Instead of, as under capitalism, the premise being each individual is an end in himself, the moral political premise of socialism is the individual is the means to the ends of society. Now, who knows what society is? I've tried to inquire. I've looked in many phone books. I can't find a phone number for society. I have no known address for society. So who's going to tell me what the ends of society are? Well, there's a very convenient group that's going to do that. They're known as the Central Committee of the Communist Party, or the Politburo. They will decide what the ends of society are. And what socialism's premise really means is the individual is a means to the ends of society as determined by the rulers. And what that means is the individual is a means to the ends of the rulers. And on that basis, it should not at all be surprising that the average citizen is not allowed to shop in the same stores, and that he is simply a serf who is working to achieve the values of the rulers. There are some incentives in a socialist society, but the whole incentive system is geared to achieve the values of the rulers. There are incentives in an army. There's an incentive for privates to go to corporal and corporals to sergeants and so on. But the purpose of that incentive system is not to make life easier for the privates. It's to make the army a more effective tool in the hands of the commanding general. Well, there are incentives in a socialist society to achieve the goals of the rulers, to achieve their military power, their prestige, and so forth. So you might get ahead if you're a secret police informer, if you contribute something to rocket research, but no one gets ahead because he can make a better pair of shoes for the average person to wear, or a better breakfast, or anything of that kind. In capitalism, where each man is an end in himself, the incentive system works to promote the well-being of each individual, and the most talented individuals in promoting their well-being are led by the inner nature, not by an unseen hand, but by the inner nature of the system to promote the well-being of every other individual who is working for his own benefit. That's in the nature of mutual trade. So we should really beware not only that capitalism is not a system of exploitation, but that socialism is. All right, well, let us now pass over to some of the other productive activities about which not very much is understood and which are written off as more or less purposeless. Let us take the financial markets and institutions and the activities of what we could call the passive capitalists, bondholders and smaller stockholders who don't take any active role in the conduct of their enterprises. Well, in order to understand the economic function of the financial markets and financial institutions, we have to keep in mind the context of a division of labor economy. We have to keep in mind the fact that the starting point of all production is an outlay of capital, and we have to keep in mind the role that capital plays in establishing a vertical division of labor and horizontal division of labor, and how it operates to raise the productivity of labor. The more that capital is formed, the more that people make available for the purchase of capital goods rather than consumer goods, the more heavily then does the economic system concentrate on the production of capital goods. I gave you the example. If the customers of General Motors want trucks and diesel locomotives rather than passenger automobiles, that's what GM produces. If savings are available to construct factory buildings rather than to build more private residences, well, the construction industry builds more factories, and on, case by case. And the effect of having more savings available for the purchase of capital goods is then to raise the productivity of labor. And this effect tends to be cumulative. When we get more capital goods, a very important point to keep in mind is that capital goods are used not merely to produce consumer goods. Capital goods are also used to produce capital goods. So what brings more capital goods into existence will make possible a second increase in the supply of capital goods. If we're producing capital goods and consumer goods now with more capital goods than we started, we'll be able to produce more of both. So the greater the extent to which the system can concentrate on the production of capital goods, it will tend to have a more rapid increase in the supply of capital goods as well as consumer goods. And this raises the productivity of labor. Now, the existence of financial markets and financial institutions, as we'll see in just a couple of minutes, promotes the degree to which the system concentrates on the production of capital goods. The growth in the supply of capital goods depends not only on the proportion of our effort that we devote to producing them, but also to the general productive efficiency of our effort. Let me give you a simple example, which I've used on previous occasions. Imagine we have a farmer who's growing a crop. He's a self-sufficient farmer, and his seed for the next planting comes out of his crop. Well, the proportion of the crop that needs to be used as seed will be less the more crop the farmer can get from any given amount of seed. Let's imagine that we have a farmer who needs one bushel of seed to produce four bushels of crop. Well, what portion of his crop is needed merely to replace seed in that case? 25%. Suppose this farmer were a more efficient farmer and he could get five bushels of crop for every one bushel of seed. Now he only needs one-fifth of his output to serve as seed. But if he continues to use a fourth or more than a fourth, he'll have more seed available next year than he had the year before. Well, no matter how complex the economic system, every year factories are getting older, they're wearing out, machinery is wearing out, raw materials are being used up, and a very large proportion of production needs to take the form of capital goods merely to replace the capital goods used up in production. If we have a more efficient economic system and can use our existing capital goods to produce more, well then the maintenance proportion will be less. The more we get from our existing capital goods, the less is the fraction of output that we need for replacement. And to whatever extent we're devoting output to capital goods, it's likely now that we'll produce more capital goods than we use up. The more efficient we are, and the larger the proportion of output in the form of capital goods, the more rapidly will we advance. Now, a free economy is much more efficient than an unfree one. We don't need as large a proportionate production of capital goods to advance as a less free economy. In the Soviet Union, the maintenance proportion is more than 100% if they couldn't count on outside aid. You may wonder why it is since 1918, supposedly they're producing heavy industry year after year. That's why the standard of living is always low. Well, that's nonsense. They're concentrating very heavily on the production of capital goods to replace all of the waste in the capital goods that they're depleting. They produce new old buildings and hydroelectric stations without generators and so on. They cannot get ahead. And their economic chaos from this inefficiency, of course, is a powerful factor making them unable to maintain their slaves in their slavery. All right, well, the existence of financial markets and financial institutions is a significant factor helping to raise the efficiency of production, and by that means to stimulate the increase in the supply of capital goods. And this hopefully will be clear in just a couple of minutes. All right, let us now look at the financial markets and financial institutions. The fact that they exist makes it worthwhile for some people to save who otherwise would not save. They make it possible for people to earn a rate of return on savings who in their absence could not earn a rate of return. Imagine for the moment that we did not have banks, we didn't have a stock exchange, a bond market, etc., etc. And there are people who are contemplating saving. Now, what would they have to do with their savings if they were not in a position to open their own business firms? They just have to sit with them if they accumulated them. They'd have to hold them in the form of cash. They wouldn't earn any return. Well, to the extent that the possibility of earning a return can be an inducement to save, it promotes saving that otherwise wouldn't occur. More importantly, savings that might occur in any case are definitely induced now to be invested. If you can earn a rate of return, you will not simply sit with your savings in the form of cash holdings, you'll invest them. So the existence of financial markets and financial institutions to some degree promotes saving that otherwise wouldn't occur. It most definitely promotes the investment of savings. And very importantly, it increases the efficiency of investment. Suppose we didn't have the financial markets and institutions, and imagine you had a business of your own where you could use your savings. But that is not necessarily the best use for your savings. If you have a small business and some extra capital you've accumulated, it doesn't necessarily follow that that's the best place for those savings to be. It might be much more important for your savings to be helping to construct an electric utility, which requires the savings of a large number of people. Well, with financial markets and institutions, we can organize large aggregates of savings to make possible the construction of types of factories and so forth, which are very important and which otherwise could not be financed. And this relates to the point of improving the efficiency of our existing ability to produce. The fact that we have a system whereby we can construct electric utilities, railroads, and so forth, things needing large concentrations of capital, and we can have this capital, instead of it being employed with a low efficiency in small undertakings, it can be concentrated and employed with great efficiency. This operates in the same way, in principle, as our farmer being able to get 5 bushels of seed for every 5 bushels of crop for every bushel of seed rather than 4. This serves to promote capital accumulation. All right, well, this is what I mean by saying in point D on page 10, point 2D, the financial markets and institutions contribute to the height of the proportionate production of capital goods and thus to economic progress, and also to the efficiency with which capital goods are produced and thus the rate of capital accumulation. Now notice you couldn't begin to understand the role of the financial system if you weren't first of all focused on the fact that production starts with capital and had some understanding of the role of capital in production. You have to recognize that we have a division of labor economy in which production begins with outlays of money and understand how this determines the extent to which we concentrate on capital goods and everything else I've been telling you. If that's not part of your intellectual context and your concept of production is limited to the direct, immediate, physical fabrication of the goods, this simply can't enter in. You don't have a broad enough intellectual context to be able to grasp the productive role of this aspect of the economic system. I think this relates in a way to Dr. Peikoff's talk. There are things that can't be understood without a sufficient intellectual context. Not only an issue of what you can integrate or not, what you can tie what you observe to. You need a certain context to be able to grasp it. Now, a few points specifically on the stock market. There are random arguments floating around against the stock market, which can be briefly addressed. In most economics textbooks, you'll find assertions made. Well, the stock market plays a role in the issue of new shares. If a company is floating a new stock issue and people buy the new stock issue, then it's understandable how the stock market contributes to capital going into business firms. But then the point is immediately made Yeah, but most of the trading in the stock market is not in new issues. It's in outstanding shares. And then it's assumed there's no connection whatever between the trading in outstanding shares and the actual operation of the economic system. Well, a few observations on that. Very few people would buy the new issues if they didn't have the ability to sell the shares they bought very easily. It's the same point Dr. Ayal made yesterday. No one would plant the teak trees if they couldn't cut them down. If you had to wait until the company you invested in liquidated, you would not be very likely to buy its stock. If you have a stock market, you as an individual can get your money out anytime you like. So it provides a powerful inducement for you to put your money in the first place. Now also, it's very often the case that the trading in outstanding shares promotes or is connected with current investment. Imagine that we have the owner of a drugstore, let's say, who would like to improve his store. And he happens to own 100 shares of IBM. Well, at any time, he can sell his shares of IBM and use the proceeds to enlarge his store. It's not the case that the holding of the shares loses all connection to further productive activity. The prices of the stocks determine the terms on which new shares can be issued. They determine whether or not it will be worthwhile to float new shares. Think of the fact each company, each share represents a certain percentage of the capital of a company. A company with 1 million shares, in such a situation, each share is 1/1 millionth of the ownership of the company. Well, the higher the price per share, the implication is the smaller the percentage of the company that needs to be given to outsiders to raise any given amount of capital. If we have a company with 1 million shares of stock and we want it to raise $10 million, well, if the price of that stock is $100 a share, then we only have to give away 10% of the company to raise the sum in question. If the price were lower, we'd have to give away a bigger chunk of the company. If the price were higher, a still smaller chunk. So the height of a company's stock price will play a very major role in determining whether or not it wants to issue additional shares. The higher the price, the more likely it will be to issue additional shares because it can obtain any given sum of capital in exchange for a smaller percentage of the ownership of the company. And it should be noted, the stock market gives economic power to small stockholders. If the management of a company treats the smaller stockholders unfairly, the price of the stock is going to be lower. People will sell the stock. On the one side, that operates to deprive the company of the ability to sell new shares. It will make the sale of new shares not worthwhile. And on the other side, it opens the company up to the possibility of a takeover. If a company is mismanaged is treating its stockholders poorly, this will be reflected in the price of its stock, and it becomes relatively inexpensive for an outside group to take the company over. Of course, such managements turn to the government to try to stop outside takeovers, as we can see all around us. An aside in connection with this point, there are legislators who believe there's something sacred about the existing makeup of companies, and outside raiders are coming to destroy the companies. They buy it, and then they sell off assets and so on. This is an important function of the financial markets. Very often, the assets of a company would be better off broken up in a different way, distributed in a different pattern. And when corporate raiders come in and they find that the stock of a company is cheap, and they can sell the assets off for more than they've had to pay for the stock, that is an indication of the fact that the assets will play a more, make a greater economic contribution somewhere else. All right, let me pass to the productive functions of retailing and wholesaling. As I pointed out in lecture one, very often retailing and wholesaling are depicted as just being there to add markups on to the prices of manufacturers and farmers. And they're viewed as making the products more expensive. People think, well, look, the manufacturer only gets $10, but the retailer is getting $40. Well, I have an interesting experiment that people should try if they doubt the value of retailing and wholesaling. Let them try to pay the direct manufacturer or farmer's price. Now, for example, if you'd like to buy the ingredients of breakfast, drive out to the farms and buy some eggs, drive over to some other farm, buy bacon and so on, and you'll be paying the lower prices, and then we'll have to raise the question, which is the more expensive way of getting breakfast? Well, obviously, trying to do it yourself. You might imagine a group of neighbors getting together and buying a van, and let one neighbor do this once every week to go and deal with the manufacturers and so on. Well, they would have expenses, they'd have to pay him, buy the van and so forth. The supermarkets and wholesalers and so on can do it a lot cheaper. They make the delivered price of goods less rather than more. I think this is virtually almost self-evident. A word on wholesaling, because sometimes the function of wholesalers is not understood. Imagine that in a given geographical territory, we have 1,000 retailers of the same kind. Let's say 1,000 of these little shops that you find in hotels and motels that are selling magazines and cigarettes and shaving cream, on and on. Stationary cigar store types, we used to call them. Now, suppose each of these 1,000 stores carries the products of 100 manufacturers. If they want to deal directly with the manufacturers, we have 100,000 small transactions. A lot of that many letters, telephone calls, salesman's visits, and so forth. If instead there's one wholesaler in between, we can have the wholesaler making 1,000 large transactions with the manufacturers, 100 large transactions with the manufacturers, and 1,000 large transactions with the retailers. We reduce the number of transactions from 100,000 to 1,100. We have a tremendous saving in costs and transactions. It's common, for example, for university libraries to find it cheaper to buy their books from a wholesaler rather than the publisher. Because when they order from the wholesaler, they're giving him an order perhaps for 2,000 books at once, and he's dealing with many other universities and the retailers and so forth, and he's buying from the publishers in great quantity, while if they had to go ahead and deal directly with the publisher, there'd be a very substantial expense just on the correspondence. Now, a fundamental point here: what is it that makes retailing and wholesaling necessary? Why is there such a phenomenon? It's a consequence of the existence of the division of labor. In a division of labor, each product originates in a tremendous concentration. A company manufacturing buttons turns out tens of millions of buttons. That's far more than the workers and capitalists of the button company can ever dream of using. And everyone else has no buttons. And by the same token, these people need all kinds of other goods which they're not producing. Well, all the different goods in a division of labor economy come into being in enormous concentrations. And there's a major problem. These goods have to be physically very widely distributed to the ultimate consumers. Well, that's what retailing and wholesaling are there to do. They're not necessary in Robinson Crusoe's economy, where the producer and the consumer are one and the same person, Or if we have an economy of self-sufficient farm families, there's no need for retailing and wholesaling. But there is a need in a division of labor economy. But you see, the concept of productive activity that so many people walk around with does not take into account the existence of the division of labor. The same principle applies to advertising. Robinson Crusoe does not need advertising. He's the producer, and he already knows immediately what products he's produced. But where the producers and the consumers are separate individuals, it is necessary for the consumers to know what the producers are doing. And that is the essential function of advertising. It's something whose existence is necessitated by the division of labor. That's the fundamental underlying fact. Now, a few misunderstandings on advertising. The textbook authors try to come up with every argument they can dream up against advertising. If you've taken an economics course, there's a high probability you've heard something like this. Toothpaste brand A starts to advertise. And by doing so, it attracts additional customers. All right, it doesn't have to raise its price. It's got the extra volume. But now toothpaste brands B and C, etc., they've lost customers. So they decide to start advertising. And now they win back as many customers from brand A as they had originally lost. And now all the different brands end up with the same number of customers they started with. The only thing that's different is they all have an additional cost that they didn't have before, the cost of advertising. And now they all have to raise prices. And then the argument may go on, well, brand A will now intensify its advertising and will have a repetition of the same process, and ultimately will buy a little speck that's surrounded by huge advertising puffery. That's the nature of the goods that we buy. All right, well, let us look at this argument. Let us assume that the different brands do all end up with the same number of customers. I think that, in fact, is unlikely. I think some will probably gain much more than the others and achieve economies of scale in production, and the price most likely will end up lower. But let us assume that the case is as the textbook authors assume, and the different brands end up with the same number of customers, and they now have a cost on account of advertising that they didn't have before. Well, there is still a significant net gain, which is the customers of the different brands are not the same individuals. There are some people who, because of advertising, used to use brand B. They've been induced to try A, which they decide they like better. And then there are individuals who used to use A, who advertising has led to try B, which they decide better. They like better. Well, the net result is, even though we have the same number of people using the different brands, the individuals are better satisfied with the same production. And that is a gain. Now, that has a cost to it, but the cost is accompanied by the gain. It's not a wasteful expenditure. And the advertising does not go on limitlessly. In the same way that if you're putting sugar in a candy bar, up to a certain point, more sugar may make the candy bar taste better, but after a point, the sugar is less effective and may ruin the taste. Well, there is an optimum point for advertising. When you've advertised enough so that people know who you are, they've gotten the message, further advertising has less and less effect and might even have a negative effect. And if we have instances in which companies are spending excessively for advertising, this is a very simple remedy from the other companies. They should use some of their advertising budgets to advertise the fact that their costs are lower and their prices are lower. That puts a limit to the process. Now, advertising promotes the development and introduction of new products that otherwise might not be developed or introduced. You know, it's sometimes said that a good product doesn't need advertising. This used to be the thought of the Hershey Chocolate Company. Now, there may be truth to that proposition that if you have a good product, ultimately word of mouth will lead everyone to know about it. But what is also absolutely true is that if you advertise a good product, people are going to know about it a lot faster. A good product will achieve a mass market faster if it's advertised. And the speed with which the market is achieved can be a significant consideration. If you achieve the large market faster, you can achieve economies of scale faster. You also don't have as great a problem in defraying, in covering costs of research and development. Imagine that we have a product that has some significant research and development cost. Well, we think back to the discussion we had about the effect of the rate of profit compounding in determining relative prices, you know, in connection with criticizing the Marxist version of the labor theory of value. Suppose we have a product that has, let's say, $100 million research and development expense. Now, if this product has to depend on word-of-mouth advertising, just word-of-mouth to spread the information about it, well, perhaps it'll take 20 years before this product achieves a mass market. If the rate of profit on capital is 10%, and it's going to take 20 years before we can get the mass market, what does that imply about the amount of money we'll have to be charging in the product in order to cover our research and development outlay? It's going to be that $100 million compounded by the rate of profit for 20 years. If we could get the mass market next year instead of in 20 years, the extent to which research and development costs have to be covered in the price of the product will be much less. There'd be a greater likelihood that the product can be marketed. If we have to cover the compounding of a significant rate of profit for a long period of time because the product doesn't achieve a mass market any sooner, well, it may be that when we that we'll never get a mass market because the price will just be too high. But if we could develop that mass market quickly, then the cost of research and development does not weigh as heavily. And so in this way, advertising operates to favor research and development that otherwise wouldn't pay. And also it should be realized that advertising promotes new entrants into a field. It promotes competition. If we didn't have advertising and a new company wants to enter a field, well, people tend to go by their experience, and their experience is always the experience of the existing firms. Well, advertising can give people a perception of the new firm and induce them to try its products. It overcomes the disadvantage of the disadvantage for it of having to compete against other firms with well-established reputations. It will make people aware of it sooner. And finally, advertising operates as a kind of bond posted with the public. You know, it's not true at all that all the advertisers have to do is advertise and then the people, robot-like, automatically go and buy the products. There's a saying in the advertising industry with a great deal of truth to it that it only pays to advertise good products. I know this is the case in the publishing industry. The publishers have limited overall advertising funds, and they're watching very keenly how books are selling with minimal advertising allocations. And then if they see a book starting to move where they haven't put a major advertising effort in, then they'll start pouring that effort in because they know they've got something that people are ready to buy, and if you make them aware of this, you'll have customers. When you advertise a good product, you can induce people to try it, the people will try it, and because it's a good product, they will join your advertising campaign. They'll tell other people, hey, I've just tried something that I like, it's really good. You should try it. If you have a poor product and you've advertised it, you may get people to try it, and then they say, oh, I've tried this dog of a product, the people you get to try it first are then advertising against you. It's unlikely and will be unusual for such advertising to pay. When a company is willing to commit a major advertising budget to something, that is a sign that it has confidence in the quality of its product. If the product is not worthwhile, it's going to turn out that their advertising budget is a waste. Okay, well, I think I've said what I wanted to say on the subject of the different productive functions, perhaps a little speedily. I'd like to come back now to the theory of profit, the net consumption theory in particular. And I want to spend the remaining time available to me tracing out the connections between the net consumption theory and classical economics. The basic definitions that I used in deriving the net consumption theory, productive expenditure, consumption expenditure, capital goods, etc., I've already explained come at least implicitly from Adam Smith, despite the tremendous errors that Smith had in connection with profits as a deduction from wages. Going further, David Ricardo has a doctrine on profits which at first hearing sounds absolutely horrible. I think I've told you his doctrine on profit is profits rise as wages fall and fall as wages rise. It seems to imply open class warfare. Let me see. Yeah, here's a brief quotation. If a manufacturer always sold his goods for the same money, for 1,000 pounds, for example, his profits would depend on the price of the labor necessary to manufacture those goods. His profit would be less when wages amounted to 800 pounds than when he paid only 600 pounds. In proportion, then, as wages rose, would profits fall. All right, sounds absolutely horrible. But if you read Ricardo carefully, it turns out that a radically different interpretation can be placed on this doctrine. Let us consider, first of all, who it is that pays wages, at least in the eyes of the classical economists. Is it the consumers who buy the product, or is it the capitalist who has the capital? It's the capitalist who pays wages. Well, if there are no capitalists, if you think back to the discussion of yesterday, if there are no capitalists, profits will rise and wages will fall. That's true. And what is the economic role of the capitalists? They're responsible for the rise in wages and the fall in profits. This doctrine, in fact, does not imply a class conflict, but a harmony of interest between wage earners and capitalists. Because it says, the full context is, it's the capitalists who pay the wages. The higher the wages, the lower the profits. The higher the productive expenditure, the lower the profits. The capitalists are responsible for the existence of wages, productive expenditure, and costs, and for profits being lower. Now, if you're a wage earner and you had the rational view, you wanted rationally to promote the interests of the average wage earner. You were in favor of wages being as high as possible relative to the total income in the economic system. What would you want to have in your country? As many and as big capitalists as possible. Imagine you're a guerrilla in the hills of Central America. And you're complaining the capitalists are exploiting the people of my country, and you're doing everything you can to see that they don't come there, or if they're there, that they get out. Well, you are actively working to lower the demand for labor and wages. If you truly wanted to raise the demand for labor and wages and reduce the rate of profit as far as profit depends on net consumption, what you'd be advocating is the absolute security of private property. And that, I think, is what really follows from Ricardo's doctrine. And if you read Ricardo carefully, even in the examples he gives of a fall in wages, he's not talking of a fall in real wages. He's talking of a fall in total wage payments in money, and in a context which is perfectly consistent with a rise in real wages. To take his own example, profits would be higher when wages were 600 pounds rather than 800 pounds. We'll now generalize this to the whole economy. We have 1,000 of sales receipts for consumer goods. In one context, wages are 800, profits 200. In another, wages 600, profits 400. Well, in that very type of contrast, Ricardo also said production might well be doubled, prices might be cut in half. Even if wages were 600 rather than 800, at half the prices, what has happened to the buying power of the wages? Yes? They're greater. Will they be 1.5 times, 600 over 800 times 2, 3/4 times 2. Now, if you want to this exact discussion, it's in one of the later sections of Chapter 1 of Principles of Political Economy and Taxation. In fact, real wages, as I've shown, will be higher when the total demand for labor is also higher. The example should be reversed. If wages are 800 rather than 600 and profits 200, well, it would more likely be in that context the prices would be halved rather than going in the opposite direction. But the point is, he was talking of wages in a context, Ricardo is known for theorizing about an invariable standard of value. There's a lot of confusion among professional economists as just what he meant by that. And I think if you want to read Ricardo, a good way to understand what he's talking about is to read him with the following assumption in mind. When he talks about an invariable standard of value, make the assumption that what he really means is there's a constant fixed quantity of money in the economic system, and there's a fixed total amount of spending to buy products. Now, why is that an invariable standard of value? Any changes in prices, then, will reflect changes on the side of production. If we have only so much spending to buy the products, all changes in prices will reflect changes on the side of production, not changes on the side of money. It's in that context that he's talking about wages falling and profits rising, in the context of an invariable standard of value. And it does not at all mean that real wages or the standard of living of the wage earners has to fall to make profits rise. Now, what is extremely important, and this is a proposition with all kinds, yes, there's a question here. Well, what Ricardo is saying, Ricardo's doctrine, I think, is a special case of the net consumption theory. Ricardo is saying producers sold their goods for the same amount of money and paid less wages, profits would be higher. Now, he's viewing things as though the only thing that's being sold are consumers' goods. If the only thing that was sold were consumers' goods, well, what would allow receipts from the sale of consumer goods to exceed wages? Net consumption. Now, Ricardo doesn't name net consumption. He's not aware of it. But that is what would be necessary to allow receipts from the sale of consumer goods to exceed wages. Now, what I did yesterday, I assumed that total sales receipts were always staying at 1,000. And what was happening to profits as productive expenditure fell? They were going up. Well, Ricardo, instead of talking about total sales revenues as productive expenditure goes up and down, he's talking about consumer sales revenues as total wages go up and down. It's the same basic idea. There are a few deficiencies there. One is he's neglecting the spending to buy capital goods as part of the sales revenues and as part of the productive expenditure. He's got it confined just to consumption and just to wages. And he doesn't explicitly go into the issue of what makes it possible for the sales to exceed the wages. But it is implicit that it would be the consumption of the businessmen. And a further deficiency would be assuming that the sales revenues always have to stay the same. But I think his basic thought can be viewed as a special case of the theory I myself am propounding. Now, let me reinforce this by quoting a very well-known passage from classical economics, which is a passage I 1,000% endorse, and on the basis of which I think its author has to be accorded a very prominent place in the history of economic thought, despite some very bad other things he may have done. And this is John Stuart Mill propounding the doctrine that demand for commodities is not demand for labor. That when you act as a consumer, you're not paying wages, that it's the capitalist who pays wages. Let me quote Mill. There are two passages. I apprehend that if by demand for labor be meant the demand by which wages are raised, or the number of laborers in employment increased, demand for commodities does not constitute demand for labor. I conceive that a person who buys commodities and consumes them himself does no good to the laboring classes, and that it is only by what he abstains from consuming and expends in direct payments to laborers in exchange for labor that he benefits the laboring classes or adds anything to the amount of their employment. Well, this ties in very closely with Ricardo's doctrine on profits. The buyers of the consumer's goods are not paying wages. Who pays the wages? It's the capitalists. What's necessary for the capitalists to pay more wages? They have to consume less. Well, in degree that the capitalists act as capitalists and make productive expenditures, then we will have higher wages relative to the sales revenues. Let me quote Mill further. We pass now to a fourth fundamental theorem respecting capital, which is perhaps oftener overlooked or misconceived than even any of the foregoing. What supports and employs productive labor is the capital expended in setting it to work, and not the demand of purchasers for the produce of the labor when completed. Demand for commodities is not demand for labor. The demand for commodities determines in what particular branch of production the labor and capital shall be employed. It determines the direction of the labor, but not the more or less of the labor itself, or of the maintenance or payment of the labor. These depend on the amount of the capital or other funds directly devoted to the sustenance and remuneration of labor. This theorem, that to purchase produce is not to employ labor, that the demand for labor is constituted by the wages which precede the production and not by the demand which may exist for the commodities resulting from the production, is a proposition which greatly needs all the illustration it can receive. It is to common apprehension a paradox, and even among political economists of reputation, I can hardly point to any, except Mr. Ricardo and Monsieur Say, who have kept it constantly and steadily in view. Almost all others occasionally express themselves as if a person who buys commodities, the produce of labor, was an employer of labor and created a demand for it as really and in the same sense as if he had bought the labor itself directly by the payment of wages. It is no wonder that political economy advances slowly when such a question as this still remains open at its very threshold. Well, now, apply that passage to Adam Smith's early and rude state of affairs. What are the buyers buying? Or Marx's CMC? Yes? Commodities. Are they paying any wages? No. Well, this is pure classical economics from Mill. There's zero wages when we simply have manual workers producing and selling products. Smith made a horrendous mistake, a contradiction of principles of classical economics. And in fact, he himself has passages where he knows better. Let me quote you very briefly some further passages from Adam Smith. All right, listen to this. He, the wage earner's employers, constitute the third order, that of those who live by profit. It is the stock that is employed for the sake of profit, which puts into motion the greater part of the useful labor of every society. The plans and projects of the employers of stock regulate and direct all the most important operations of labor, and profit is the end proposed by those plans and projects. Well, that is getting close to saying it's the businessmen and capitalists who are supplying the guiding, directing intelligence. Then he has a further observation in the same paragraph. But the rate of profit does not, like rent and wages, rise with the prosperity and fall with the declension of the society. On the contrary, it is naturally low in rich and high in poor countries, and is always highest in the countries going fastest to ruin. Well, at what greater state of ruin could you be than in the early and rude state of society? That's exactly where the rate of profit should be highest. And then he says elsewhere, the demand for those who live by wages, it is evident, cannot increase but in proportion to the increase of the funds which are destined for the payment of wages. And capital is the source of those funds. That's what we were just told in the paragraph before. Well, you see, there are a certain number of paragraphs of The Wealth of Nations, and to a lesser extent, Ricardo, which just need some either to be stricken out or to have some important explanatory commentary or an explanation. This is a contradiction. And a very, very different doctrine emerges. All right, let me... the one element in classical economics that needs to be thoroughly expurgated is any notion of a connection between wages and subsistence. But even there, the classical economist's explanation of the connection was radically different than Marx. As I've explained, they thought more population will mean a greater need to grow food, will encounter diminishing returns in agriculture, that will raise the price of necessities, that cuts real wages. Marx's idea was the capitalists arbitrarily put wages at subsistence. Now, it's understandable why the early classical economists might have thought that wages tend to go to subsistence. That was the record of all human history prior to the Industrial Revolution. When wages got above subsistence for a limited time, people simply were able to raise larger numbers of offspring. Then we had to grow food under less favorable circumstances, and pretty soon the standard of living sank to a lower level. But they started to have glimmerings that this need not be the case. Anyway, that is the one doctrine that absolutely needs to be stricken out. Let me say a few words about the connection of the net consumption theory with the theory of time preference. I think that the doctrine of net consumption is actually necessary to make the time preference theory of interest valid? Time preference, in my judgment, operates on the rate of profit and interest by way of determining the rate of net consumption. If time preference establishes a rate of net consumption of 5%, well then the rate of return on capital to that, insofar as that's the case, will be 5%. But if we eliminate the concept of net consumption and we try to establish a direct connection between time preference and the rate of profit, I think we have to fail. And the procedure of the time preference theorists up to now has been that their argument is we prefer present goods to future goods. Let me give you in rough outline their explanation of how time preference results in profit and interest. We prefer a unit of wealth today to the same quantity and quality of wealth a year from now. Let us imagine we prefer 10 apples available now to 10 apples available a year from now. And in order to achieve some kind of rough equivalence, let us say we value 10 apples now as equal to 11 apples a year from now. So 10 apples today are of the same value to us at the margin as 11 apples a year from now. Now then they also say, well, what is the value of the totality of means of producing 11 future apples? Suppose we could assemble in a pile, as it were, all of the seed, the chemical spray, the right to use the trees, the right to use the land. We assembled absolutely all of the factors of production needed to produce 11 apples 1 year from now. All right, these would be claims to 11 future apples. What would be their value today? 10 apples. The time preference theorists say the sum of the means of production required to produce a future good has a discounted present value. So the means of producing 11 apples to be available 1 year from now is 10 apples. We buy the totality of the means of producing the 11 apples for only 10 apples. And now production proceeds, a year passes, we've got the 11 apples. Well, these are now 11 present apples. We bought the 11 present apples a year before. We paid a discounted price. We only paid the price of 10 present apples. Now we end with 11 present apples. That's the explanation of profit. Well, there is a major flaw in trying to get, there's more than one flaw, but I'll only go into one, in trying to explain profit this way. And that is that at the margin, we will find that people very often value future goods above present goods. It is true that if I can have one apple, other things equal, I'd rather have it now than a year from now. I would rather have my second apple today than a second apple a year from now. I'd rather have my 10th apple today than a 10th apple a year from now. Maybe I'd rather have the 10th apple than an 11th apple, the 10th apple today than an 11th apple a year from now. But notice, suppose I've got 1,000 apples available now, and next year I expect to have only 10 apples. Which would I prefer, the 1,000th present apple or an 11th future apple? The 11th future apple. Now, anybody who saves, anyone who has any savings of any kind, he could take his last $100 of savings and consume them. Why doesn't an individual take $100 of the savings that he has and decide, I'll consume them now? Because he values the use of that 100 in the future, that marginal 100, is more valuable in the future than the present. At the margin, The marginal future unit, for anyone who has savings, for anybody who has savings, the marginal future unit is more valuable than the first submarginal present unit. Now, on the basis of this, in a little-known passage, Bohm Bawerk, the main father of the time preference theory, gave up the doctrine. I want to quote you this passage from Bohm Bawerk. It's from Capital and Interest. It appears in a footnote. If anyone is interested after the lecture, I'll give you the exact page. It's from the Hunke Zenholtz translation. All right, he says, I have to preface this by saying, Bohm Bawerk advanced three causes for the higher valuation of present over future goods. The third cause really has nothing to do with time preference. It has to do with technical conditions of production. This is generally recognized by anyone who's read Bohm Bawerk. So keep in mind, the third cause really does not relate to time preference. Let me quote you this key passage now. He says, "There are persons who are excessively well provided for in the present, or at least would be if they wished to use up completely all the means available to them in the present, including the principal of their fortunes. This explains one point in connection with persons who command in the present greater means than in deference to sound economy they may permit themselves to consume in the present. I refer to the fact that they would regularly arrive at approximate equivalence in their valuation of present and future goods if the first two main causes of a higher valuation of present over future goods alone were operative. In their case, the decision in favor of present goods can be brought about only through the operation of the third main cause, the discussion of which follows immediately at this point in the text." Well, notice, what this means is, for whoever has savings, Bohm Bawerk is recognizing that individuals with savings value the marginal future unit above the marginal present unit. And the whole formula of the time preference theory then breaks down. Now, I do not know if this problem is even recognized by the proponents of the time preference theory, the contemporary proponents. I have not seen it addressed. In my judgment, it means that you cannot apply this sort of formula. You can't say, well, 10 present apples equal 11 future apples, the means of making 11 future apples, voila, that's how we get profit. Because in fact, at the margin, a present apple will not have a greater value than a future apple for whoever has savings. The marginal dollar saved does not have a higher valuation. The marginal dollar saved has a higher valuation than an extra dollar that might be consumed. The dollar put aside for the future is considered more important than an extra dollar of consumption. Now, that is not addressed. Now, I think time preference is a legitimate explanation of the rate of profit and interest, but if we use it to explain the rate of net consumption. If people have a high time preference, well, then net consumption is going to be high. That will make the rate of profit high. But time preference has to manifest itself in net consumption. Now, I see a question from Mr. Ballou. Right.
Does the question of the expectation of earning future interest on savings complicate this argument?
Does the expectation of earning future interest on savings complicate the argument? No, the argument is advanced to explain the interest. See, the time preference doctrine is propounded in order to explain interest, so we can't take that as a starting point. They're saying the reason that profit interest exists, what they say is, the reason profit, which they call originary interest, the reason that exists is, in effect, 10 present apples are as valuable as 11 future apples. So we buy the means of producing the 11 future apples at a price equivalent to 10 present apples. That explains how we make a profit. Then interest rates on loans come into existence because you can make, quote, originary interest.
No, that's not quite clear.
just that you're saying that the marginal future use of a dollar, for example, for someone who has savings, may be greater than the present value of $1. And then the question is, though, I also expect to earn money on that $1 that I'm saving. I'm wondering if that complicates your argument.
No, I don't see why at all, because let's suppose you're not earning any interest. Even without interest, you would prefer a future dollar to an extra present dollar. I mean, here you are. You have to view the future. There's going to come a time when you may not be able to earn an income. You could spend this income now. You could spend more today. But what would you rather have? Would you rather have some extra night out, or would you rather provide for a time when you might not be able to afford a can of beans? Which is more important to you, the first unit of food at some point in the future or the 10th unit today? And I think practically everyone who has any degree of rationality would prefer the first future unit to the 10th present unit. And that means at the margin, we have people valuing future units above present units. Now, what I will say is, if we take a unit with the same marginal position, if you ask, would I rather have my first unit of food today or in 10 years, today. If you ask, would I prefer the 10th unit today to the 10th unit in 10 years, today. But the question is, do I prefer the 10th today to the first in the future, then the first in the future? Now, there are some people for whom even that is not true, but they don't count for very much in the economic system, and their activity does not significantly affect anything. So, in my judgment, a necessary link in the explanation of time preference in determining the rate of profit has to be by way of net consumption. If we have people with an extremely high time preference who wish only to consume in the immediate moment, well, then there's no productive expenditure, there'll be no capital, the rate of profit will be infinite. In degree that time preference is less, productive expenditure will be greater, the amount of capital accumulated will be greater, the rate of profit will be lower. But you need net consumption as a vital intermediate link. So let me make a wider point here. I think that on this issue, and on many others too, classical and Austrian economics complement each other. They are not, to mix them is not to be eclectic, but to take different fundamental insights which are perfectly consistent and reinforce one another. Interestingly, this was sensed by Lionel Robbins, a prominent British economist of the last generation, in his foreword to Wicksteed's Common Sense of Political Economy. He observed that even though Austrian economics seemed to be so very different than classical economics, in a way, these two had much more in common than what later became the so-called mainstream. And I would think on the time preference theory, you know, Ricardo in many ways sees the role of time better than von Bawerk. And the net consumption theory, I think, provides an integration between Ricardo and the body of classical economics and the time preference theory. And there are other major connections where the two reinforce one another. So I would say to all of you who plan to study economics, by all means, read all of the leading Austrian economists. But also, after you've done that, you should read the leading classical economists. And was there another question back here? Are we out of questions? Bob Klein. I would be glad to do that, but let me ask first if there are any questions specific to today's discussion first. This gentleman right here.
Yeah, on this question of time preference. If you defer consumption of some of the wealth that you have, and invest it in, say, a factory, even if you had no preference for, say, a given Apple or given any given product, whether you got it today or tomorrow, isn't the fact that you did it, that by deferring consumption, you actually use more of those things, doesn't that explain why you might want to defer consumption?
Are you saying if you save and accumulate capital, you can produce more? You'll have a larger supply of goods in the future than in the present. Mightn't that be why you wish to do it? Well, that is a possibility, and that is not inconsistent with the time preference theory. The time preference theory says the only reason that we would save and provide for the future is if giving up a given amount of possible consumption in the present will make possible achieving more in the future. So they'd say, if the factory adds, enables us to produce more in the future, it will offset our time preference. In fact, the major contemporary explanation of profit interest that you'll find in a textbook like Samuelson is a combination of the time preference and productivity theories. They say, on the one side, in order to save, people have time preference, they don't want to save, they'd rather consume. They can only be induced to save if they will receive more than they have to give up in the way of current consumption. And then on the other side, it said, what makes this possible is that the saving has a productivity, there's a productivity of capital. And then we get into what is called the productivity theory. Well, the productivity theory does not hold either. The fact that having capital goods enables you physically to produce more cannot, in fact, explain the monetary rate of profit. See, let us take this example. Suppose that in the economic system as a whole, each year, there is $1 trillion of sales revenue. Let's call it 1,000 so we don't have to hold all those zeros. There's 1,000 units of sales revenue. And the total monetary outlay each year required to buy the labor, the equipment, the materials, to produce the product, whatever it is 900 units of money. What is the monetary profit? What's the money amount of profit? 100. Now, suppose it happens that next year, for whatever reason, we are physically able to produce twice as much as we could this year. We spend 900 for the means of production. We're going to sell the product for 1,000 units of money, only the product is physically doubled in size. What will happen? Pardon me? Won't the price of the product be cut in half? The selling price of the product will be cut in half. What will be our monetary profit in the economic system? It's still 100. So the physical productivity of capital is not the determining element. Now, please bear with me just for a moment, because there's a brilliant passage on this very point by Ricardo. I'd very much like to find it for you. Okay, I know the general area. Okay, here's a passage from Ricardo's chapter on foreign trade, which relates directly to this subject. He says, "The remarks which have been made respecting foreign trade apply equally to home trade. The rate of profits is never increased by a better distribution of labor, by the invention of machinery, by the establishment of roads and canals, or by any means of abridging labor, either in the manufacture or in the conveyance of goods. These are causes which operate on price and never fail to be highly beneficial to consumers, since they enable them with the same labor or with the value of the same labor to obtain in exchange a greater quantity of the commodity to which the improvement is applied. But they have no effect whatever on profit. Now he's talking about the economy-wide average rate of profit. In order for there to be more dollars and cents profits, there's only one way that we can have it. The sales revenues have to exceed the costs by more. And the mere fact that there is more physical production will not achieve that. The effect of more production, from the point of view of the economic system as a whole, is to lower prices, not to increase money incomes. There is one significant exception, and that is if we have a commodity money system in which the money is gold or silver, to the extent that an increase in production means an increase in the production of gold or silver, that's an increase in the quantity of money. Then we'd have more sales revenues. Then we'd have a higher nominal rate of profit. But what's the essential element here? Do we increase the general rate of profit by virtue of making television sets and shoes and automobiles more efficiently? No. That increases the particular profits of the innovators and reduces the profits of their competitors. Technological progress does not affect the general rate of profit, except to the extent on a commodity money system, it might bring about a more rapid increase in the quantity of money. But it won't affect the general rate of profit insofar as it takes place in the production of ordinary commodities. It will operate to reduce prices. Now, you see, it's understandable why people should assume that increases in production are the decisive factor on the rate of profit. That's true for any individual. But what's being overlooked is that the individual operates in an environment of competition, and what raises the rate of profit for the successful innovator lowers the profits of his competitors. It does not operate on the general rate of profit. And let me point out in this connection something about the significance of the general rate of profit. The higher the rate of profit of any individual firm on the basis of improving its production, the better. But the higher the general economy-wide average rate of profit, the poorer. And let me concretize this for you. You've all read Atlas Shrugged. If Reardon can earn a 50% rate of profit, that's fine. If he earns it while Boyle and Mr. Moen are losing 40 or 45%, that's fine. But if when Reardon is making a 50% rate of profit, people like Boyle and Moen can be making a 30 or 40% rate of profit, there is something very wrong. The average rate of profit, the economy-wide average rate of profit, generally speaking, is inversely related to the rate of economic progress. And Smith was right in saying the countries going most rapidly to ruin have the highest rate of profit. That is true as far as the rate of profit depends on the rate of net consumption. Now, it is also true as far as the rate of profit depends on the mere increase in the quantity of money. This is something we haven't looked at yet, but everyone recognizes that inflation elevates the nominal rate of profit, and as far as that's a factor responsible, the rate of profit and economic progress are inversely related. The one limited area in which a higher rate of profit is the accompaniment of economic progress would be in the following circumstances. Suppose we have an economic system in which production is increasing from year to year. The physical ability to produce is going up. Now, the physical increase in television sets, shoes, ordinary commodities, that by itself is neutral with regard to the average rate of profit. But if we have a commodity money, and at the same time that we can produce more shoes and television sets, the same basis on which we produce more of these things spills over into the technology of mining and the mining of precious metals. If we have the supply of precious metals also growing, perhaps not growing even as much as the supply of physical commodities, well then the average nominal or money rate of profit will tend to be somewhat higher. If we had an economic system in which production was growing, let's say, 5% from year to year, if there's no increase in money, prices would fall correspondingly. If at the same time the supply of precious metal money is going up 4% a year, well then that 4% growth in the money supply will tend to add 4% to the money rate of profit. In this context, we have a higher nominal rate of profit, which is an accompaniment of greater production. It's not a problem of inflation. The profits are real. The extra profits being earned don't have any lesser buying power. There's nothing here that would raise prices. But this is the only context in which a higher rate of profit, an average rate of profit, is positively related with economic progress, is when we have the ability to produce a growing supply of goods from year to year, and a byproduct of this is an expanding quantity of money, because the money is also another physical good. Under a gold standard, we would have, within certain limits, a positive relationship between the average rate of profit and prosperity. If there's a more rapid increase in production in general, it will tend to affect the rate of increase in the supply of precious metals. That will add something to the average rate of profit. Any other context, the average rate of profit and prosperity are inversely related, because then we'll have the supply of money growing more rapidly than the supply of goods. It'll just be a fictional profit, or it will be the result of a higher rate of net consumption. All right, well, we're getting into rather technical matters. Let me take one last question. Mr. Blair. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought, forgive me, yes, yeah. Yeah.
I would rather have all 1,010 apples today, assuming they won't spoil, and ration them myself when I'm going to eat them.
You're saying you'd rather have the future good in storage. Okay, but then there's still the issue, what is the value that is higher? It's still the future use that has the higher value. And in any case where you couldn't have the storage, that in an exchange of claims to future goods against present goods, if time preference alone were operative, if there was no intermediate link through net consumption, you wouldn't be able to get the higher valuation of the present goods in the market. I think it's necessary to stop at this point. Thank you.